Welcome to the Real Estate Investing Club. This is the place everyday real estate investors gather to share their best stories, biggest insights, and favorite tactics to grow a portfolio of cash flowing properties in today's market. Here's your host, Gabe Peterson.
All right. Welcome back to another episode of the Real Estate Investing Club. Today we have Jim Manning with us from St. Louis, Missouri. Jim is has multiple companies. He does acquisitions company. He has a fund and he does lease to own in the single family space. So good topics. We haven't covered them extensively here. So I'm super excited to jump into this. Jim, thank you very much for hopping on the show.
All right. Thanks for having me, Gabe. Excited to be here, man.
Yeah. I told you before we got on here. Actually, I did not. Usually I tell guests what to expect when we hop on the show. I didn't tell you this. So you are you're fresh. This is good. We usually start the show with stories. We like to hear where people come from, how they got into real estate. So take us to the beginning of your story. How'd you get started in real estate?
Absolutely. So out of college, I was in 2006 when I graduated. So the economy was going crazy, doom and gloom. The sky was falling.
I graduated the exact same year. I feel you, man.
Oh, you did? Okay. So same age. So I couldn't get a job. And so I started out, I got a freelance gig for a couple of weeks working for a self-made billionaire.
Oh, nice.
And so it was an amazing opportunity. And all we were doing was pulling out bottles of wine from his wine collection and printing out a label and putting the label on so he could inventory his wine and figure out how many millions of dollars of wine that he had and get insurance for it. Right.
Oh,
so it
wow.
took three of us, two full weeks of just taking a bottle out, putting a barcode on, sticking the bottle back in. And the context of this guy's wealth is at one point I had $200,000 in my hands at the same time.
Jesus
so
Christ.
I didn't add it up. I don't know how much wine this guy ended up having.
And you know you're rich when you're insuring your wine.
That's right. How do you know you're rich? Yeah. Yeah. I mean, and we were flying on at one point I flew on a private jet. I was drinking like $1,000 bottle of Krug champagne. And I was just out of college. I had no idea that I should like sip champagne that's that expensive. You know, I was still chugging like in the college days, right? But that would be the first tip of a bit of advice I'd give myself. Enjoy the expensive stuff. Don't just chuck it.
Slow down, buddy.
Yeah, yeah. So what was cool about it, though, is because it was for him personally, he was hanging out a lot with us and like we really got to know him. So out of college, no work experience whatsoever. And I'm from a middle class family, teacher and an IT person. I got to see an entrepreneur that was a self-made guy. He started this company and built it into a $1 billion enterprise, right?
Oh, wow.
And I got to meet his girlfriend, which, you know, when you're in your early 20s and you see a good looking girl, it's like, wow, how did this 60-year-old guy that's wider than tall pull this? You know, it's like just this incredibly gorgeous girl in her late 20s and you know, all the wine, the lifestyle, the private jets, you name it. So first week I started really admiring this guy and saying, man, maybe I should be an entrepreneur. Like this is what you can do in America. What an amazing country, you know? So I think that kind of was an initial spark for me.
What industry did he make his money in?
He was in trucking.
Trucking. Okay.
Yeah. So logistics. And so anyway, but then the second week went around and we did a good job and he invited us to go to his Palm Springs house and it was over Thanksgiving vacation. And then he invited us to Thanksgiving dinner. And I was like, man, maybe this guy's going to like offer me a job or something. He likes me enough to invite me to Thanksgiving dinner. Like, wow, like what in the world's going on here? And sure enough, I get there and I realized I was there because if the help was there, his wife and his daughters wouldn't hate him. Or they hated him and they wouldn't yell at him. It would like actually be a peaceful Thanksgiving dinner. And as the onion peeled back, as I got to know him a little bit better, I realized that, wow, this guy on the surface achieved the ultimate entrepreneurial successful life. Right. And then on the other hand, he was more miserable than my middle-class parents are. You know, and actually I should say that back. My middle-class parents are happy, you know, he was like really miserable and here they are happy and they didn't achieve that. Right. So as a 22-year-old, it really taught me the lesson that we should measure our success by what we gave up to get it. And so like I had that spark, and then I also had the entrepreneurial spark, but I also had the awareness of what it cost. So then I started in a corporate America job, realized that it wasn't for me. I really needed to be an entrepreneur. And so then I started studying different avenues of what to do. And I fell in love with real estate because there's not a, you know, the ceiling is as how good I can get at it. So there's the financial upside. There's positive benefits for the community. There's, you know, you can feel good about what you do and some of the problems you can solve for people. And at the same time, like I felt like I could control it and still be very much God focused, family focused, and also have work at the same time, not feeling like I had to give up everything to achieve financial wealth. And so that was really why I got into it and where the journey started in real estate. Gosh, oh, I feel old now. I'm losing my hair.
We're not that old.
I'm going to be 40 this year.
Hey,
and actually in 4 days, I'm going to be 40. Awesome. Yeah, I mean, so it's been 18 year journey investing. We've done over 3,500 deals as a team now. So it's been a minute. We've done a tremendous amount of deals and so hopefully we can share some valuable nuggets here for your audience here, Gabe.
Nice. Yeah, that is I feel like that's a really good first introduction to the working world, to see someone who has really achieved the pinnacle of what the working world can give you, but also see that kind of in juxtaposition to what they, you know, what they had to give up, what they if you really want to reach that level, then there's a chance that you're going to suffer in other areas. So finding that balance, and real estate really does, in my opinion, give you that balance. So we made it to the right area. Love to hear that. 18 years, that's a long time. Hey, 40 is a great milestone. It's this is you know, a good time in your life. I'm 37, so I got 3 more years. So you know, I'm in my 30s for another couple of years.
Good for you.
Let's talk about the evolution of that, those 18 years. How did they, you know, when you did that first deal, you decided real estate's where I want to go. What was the first deal that you did, and how, what was the strategy you used to take it out?
Yeah. So I bought a property that was a short sale from my now business partner. He wholesaled it to me, bought and sold it in the same day. And I fixed it up with a business partner, and then resold it, and we made $20,000 on the flip. And for a 22-year-old to get 10 grand in your bank account, man, what a wonderful day that was. You know, so then I was like, well, I'm rich. I got 10 grand in my bank account. And I had been, while that was going on, I had been
thinking about taxes, just like whatever.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, yeah, I don't, of course not. Yeah. That would have been way too much foresight for a 22-year-old. But then I was investing into Apple stock as well before first iPhone came out. Ooh. And so I was able to put 5 grand in, and then that doubled into, and so then I had the 10 grand from the real estate deal, the 10 grand, the 5 grand of profit, and the 5 grand I had put in from the Apple stocks, which gave me $20,000 of seed money that then I was like, okay, I'm doing it. I'm quitting my job. And my, my mom and dad were just like, what are you doing?
Like 20,000 is not a lot of money.
Yeah, this is the dumbest idea in the world. And I'm like, well, I'm rich. I got 20 grand. I'm doing it. I'm going for it. And then, so we started out doing property flips. And the lender would pay, I had a private lender, an individual paying 100% of the purchase price. And then I would take my 20 grand and I would put that into the repairs and pay for the repairs. And then, you know, it took a couple of years, but then I was able to build up to 3 deals at a time doing it that way. And that was when we really hit our first ceiling of growth. And every business has that, right? Like you're at a certain stage, and then to get to that next level, you have to break through. And, we were trying to break through, but we were stuck on the amount of money that we had, because, you know, that was our restriction. So we wanted to grow more, but, you know, we didn't exactly know what was holding us back. And then I had a personal thing come up. I had 3 of the houses that we had were sitting on the market. We had made buying mistakes. I had a health issue. I fainted. Apparently, I'm a softy. I don't know. I
low blood sugar or something like that.
I don't know. I passed out, and I'm 6'2", and I passed out in the hospital. I was visiting my grandma. The last thing I remember.
Good place to pass out of all places, though.
Oh, well, maybe, but this is what happened, though. My grandma was having internal bleeding, and I just remember thinking, like, oh my gosh, grandma's dying. And like, that was like my last thought. And I'm 6'2", and a hospital floor is concrete. So if you pass out when you're 6'2", and no one's there to catch you, because I was standing behind my dad, I hit my head first, like on the concrete. And if people that see me in person, I can kind of, now that I'm 40, I can wrinkle my head, and there's a dent here still for how hard I hit the floor. And so I hit the floor. And then the way I hit the floor, I had a severe concussion, and people, I kind of like shaked because I had fainted and passed out, and people weren't sure, am I having a brain thing or what was going on with it, right? So if you have a seizure, you're not allowed to drive for 6 months. They weren't sure if I had one or not. But they said, you know what, you better just play it safe and not drive for 6 months. So I had three properties that were stalled on the market that I couldn't rely on for income. And I was in a situation where I was going to break even on one. And I had a ton of my own cash in that one. I had more of the repair money in that one than the other two. One of them I was going to make a little bit of money on, and the other one I was going to lose a ton of money on. But I couldn't sell the one I was going to lose a ton of money on until I sold the one that I had a ton of cash of repair money in. So we were in this crazy environment where three houses were stalled, but I needed to not only sell them, but I needed to sell them in the right order.
In the right order, yeah.
In order to be able to afford to pay the loss on the one, right? So that created a huge challenge, not being able to drive for 6 months and then facing that. Luckily, I had my real estate license. And the real estate license was like, okay, well, I guess we can just be agents for a little while. And we started doing short sale listings. We did 50 that year, and we figured out, okay, well, if we're going to scale our investing business, why don't we have an agent team and start making commissions and at least have another revenue to, in case we make an investment mistake, we don't have to rely on that. So at that point we really founded a second company, and we're running a whole agent team as an additional, income source. And we were able to write out those mistakes. And what we still wanted to do more investment deals as well. And then what unlocked the scaling up from our investment deal standpoint was how we structured the financing. So we decided, we're like, well, people trust us enough to give us 100% financing on the purchase price. Well, what if we go to them and say, why don't you just give us 100% on the repairs and purchase price? So we went to our existing investors that have been with us for 3 years. They said, oh yeah, well, I don't care. I'll make more money if I give you more money. And so they were on board with it. And then now all of a sudden, the amount of deals we could do wasn't limited by capital or restricted by capital. It was only restricted by the amount of money we could raise and the amount of deals we could find. And once we unlocked that, that was our next kind of level, right? And we already had additional revenue coming in from the agent deals. So we were fortifying ourselves from that standpoint as well. And then we were able to scale up. And I mean, at our height of flips was back in 2016 or 2017. I look at it sometimes and I don't ever remember it for some reason. We had 120 flips going at the same time.
Oh my God. That's ridiculous.
And I remember not having like any sort of awareness of how much that was. And then I looked at the biggest brokerage in our area. Was Keller Williams Chesterfield, and this was in January. And I looked at their office and they only had 105 listings at the same time we owned 120 houses that we were in the process of flipping. So it was like, funny. Oh, okay. Like, I guess we're doing some deals here, but, but yeah, I mean, it's been a journey, guys, the journey of an entrepreneur. I mean, I've made a ton of mistakes, and, there's been a lot of lessons learned. So, it has not been a smooth, perfect ride the whole time. That's for sure.
I, 120 flips at once, to me, just seems obscene because, you know, I'm in the commercial side, self-storage, mobile home parks. But before that, I did flips. But I could only ever do, you know, back in 2014, we were doing flips and we could only ever do like one at a time because we couldn't find good contractors. Yeah. And I'm thinking like 120 contractor teams, or how did you get that work done? How did you find 120 good contractors? I mean, I just feel like that would take forever.
All right. Well, yeah, we'll have to dig into this just a little bit. So, the scaling up on the business, we hit our goal. Our goal was to do as many deals as we possibly can to be the biggest player in town. And St. Louis is a big city. So, I mean, there's a lot of just really quality investors in our area. So and we were able to do that. We were able to become like the biggest player when that was going on. But what I realized was like the goal was to do more deals. And when we achieved that and we got to the 120, it was that year was we bought like an extra 120 homes. We're used to buying around 100 to 150. And that year we bought in the 300s. And so we did that. And then we looked at our books. Like, whoa, we just made less money this year than we did the year before. And we did half the work. So the way we scale, we didn't do it the right way. I would love to tell you, hey, you know, we're perfect and stroke my own ego. But we said, okay, well, we scaled up. Everyone hates ourselves. We hate ourselves. Let's scale back down intentionally to the level we were at before and do it in a way that we're more controlling the cost. Because like the reality is if you do that kind of jump, then yeah, we should have already had the contractors lined up to do the deals. We had three full-time project managers and they were doing what they could, but margins shrunk because there was, we had 120 that we owned, but that we didn't have 120 that we were working on. Like the inventory got up, you know, we would maybe have 30 that we weren't working on that were sitting waiting for the other 90 to go. Right. So we didn't do it in a way that was setting up the operations properly. We got deal hungry and we saw some deals and bought a couple packages and we ended up working, they ended up working out, but like the margins were just shrunk so dramatically that it's like, well, you know, we're just spinning our wheels and we're not actually achieving anything other than to say, oh, we did more deals than you did. Like, yeah. I mean, come on. Like, who cares?
And that's a really, really easy, mistake to make in real estate because it's really hard to pass up a deal. It's just like, if you see it, you want to do it. And it takes a lot of wisdom and self-control. And the wisdom is probably going to come from you making this mistake in the past, realizing sometimes more deals is not better. And it's better to just kind of hold off. So, I'm not pointing the finger. It makes a lot of sense for me. It's good. You guys were able to make it through that 120 deals at once. Now you are one of a few people who can say they've done 120 flips at one time.
Yeah.
That's right. So you're doing flips. I know you got into the lease option space. At what point did you change your strategy from flipping to the leasing side?
Yeah. So, I mean, this is around when we were in our heyday. It was like 2016, 2017. The timeline gets murky when you get to be 40. you've been doing it 18 years, but, so Jason, he's one of our general partners in our real estate fund as well. I was in a mastermind group with him and he was saying, hey, you're doing all these flips. There's a way to make more money. Like I have the strategy already. You can make more money, take way less risk. Like, why don't you try one out? And I'm so bullheaded. It took him a year of trying to convince me to partner with him on a deal. And then finally, because like he had the art form and we had the scale, you know, we had the team to like do a bunch of deals. And finally I said, okay, like you've been telling me, you've been honest with everything else you've told me for the last couple of years we've been in this mastermind, let's do a deal together. And we do this, we do a deal that we have potential tenant buyers walking the property. There's two of them that get into a bidding war over the property. And one of them offers $30,000 down payment. The other one offers $40,000 down payment to live in this house before they move into it. So we take the $40,000, which down payment money, by the way, guys, on these deals isn't a taxable thing until they move out of the property or they execute on the lease purchase contract. So we have, I have this $40,000, which is more than what many of the flips we did, we would make in St. Louis. You know, sure, we've made six figures on several deals, but there's also deals where we've made $20,000, you know, on a flip.
Real quick before you go into it, let's talk a little bit more just about the strategy, because a lot of people probably won't understand what a lease option is, how it's structured. You know, you get that down payment, and then
Thank you, man. So the lease purchase, what it does is in commercial, like there's triple net leases that I think a lot of people are familiar with, but it basically puts the landlord in the position of the lender, and the tenant in the place in the position of the homeowner. So they get a contract that's the lease purchase contract. So they own the property by contract, and they have multiple years to be able before they're required to execute on the contract. Okay, and so basically, the tenant pays for all the repairs and all the maintenance on the property, and they are the option money. There is option money, so we call it down payment money, but. So in this case, the story I just shared with you guys, before the tenant moved in, he put $40,000 down. So when you look at a traditional landlord model versus a lease purchase model in single family real estate, if the tenant's covering the overhead, that's 20% of the operating expenses. Okay. And the best thing about flips is like, hey, you get a cash flow, like an influx coming in that you can then, do to like help build your business or just take it and go buy a car or whatever. Right. So it kind of marries the two a little bit because you get that down payment money. So there is that cash flow coming in. But then long-term wise, you make a tremendous amount of more money, like over the course of a 30-year deal structure, which is some of the structures that we have set up. You know, there's $1 million of profit, you know, so I'm looking at it saying, okay, well, we are happy with making $25,000-$30,000 on these flips versus I can get the same amount of money down payment that I don't owe taxes on. And then I can hold on to it and make a tremendous amount of cash flow over the course of the next several decades. So and it's far less risky because we've extended the exit strategy too. So we started doing a few of them, and then we were just like, okay, yeah, we're going to shift our entire company into doing these strategies. It's a fantastic investment opportunity.
Yeah.
And yeah. So did I explain the lease purchase structure? Okay. Is that?
Yeah. It's I like the idea, or I like the idea of using triple net as a comparison, because that is kind of what it is. It's a triple net with a down payment at the front. And then an option at the very end where they can buy it at a predefined price.
I really think that's the holy grail of investing, guys, whatever you do, whether it's mobile homes or, I mean, a lot of them work really well when you execute right. But like anytime we can increase the returns and lower the risk profile, my goodness, what a powerful position to be in.
Yeah.
So like we're talking, I got $40,000 for this tenant. Do you think they're going to damage the property and give me a reason to kick them out of that deal? That $40,000 is non-refundable.
Right.
So no, they're going to take care of the property. And then on a monthly basis, we're getting higher monthly cash flows than what a normal landlord would charge for rent too. So, that's like, so whenever you can, whatever niche you're in, however you can kind of create that, that's an incredible thing. Yeah.
So for triple or for lease option, with the model that you guys were working, it sounds like it would probably only work with the lower price point homes, correct?
No. So that's what I would have assumed. Our highest price point home, $775,000.
Okay.
it was a, I know. So, and that was one of my biggest hangups with Jason too, like, and why it took him over a year to talk me into it. I was like, are there really people that can't get a traditional loan? Like, and I have $30,000 to drop on this house. And it's like really like, you've been honest with me, so I'll take your word on it, but I don't believe you. And like, I mean, we get,
doesn't make sense.
It doesn't make sense. But when then we started doing it, and I'm like, well, we got 70 leads for this property, of which five were definitely qualified to be able to afford and buy it. And then we picked the best one, you know? So like, there's all this demand for this too. And, Anyway, I just got caught in an ADD moment. Sometimes my brain moves faster than my mouth. I don't feel like I fully answered your question. I'm sorry for that.
No, that's okay. Down
an ADD rabbit hole, but
help
me out here, man. Help me stay on track.
So you've already talked about you got into lease options, you met that guy, and you guys started going into it when you brought it to the scaling stage. Mm-hmm. Did you just apply that strategy to all the properties that you were working on, or was there something specific that you had to change about your operations in order to make it work?
Well, a couple things happened. Okay, so where to start on that? That's a great question. So we were shifting our business model into it, and we were doing very well with it, and also like I don't know about you guys, but like I mean I've been investing for 18 years now. And when you're 37 years old and you look at your portfolio, you say, okay, well, I'm good. But you're doing kind of the same thing over and over again. Like things were getting a little stale for me. I was like, is this all there is? Like a little mini midlife crisis, so to speak. things are going fantastic. We're building tremendous wealth, investing on our own. And then I had a conversation with my dad, and my dad said, hey, I'm afraid of running out of money before I die. I said, wait, what are you talking about? Like, I get it that you're middle class, but you saved your money, you did everything the financial industry taught you to do. You became a self-made millionaire. And he said, well, I'm in my 70s. The stock market's going crazy. It's going up and down and sideways. I can't time the stock market. I'm in my 70s. They forced me to take money out. I'm on fixed income. Inflation's going through the roof. You know, if I live to be 90, I'm fine. I got enough. If I live to be 100, I don't know. You know, much less get in like a really serious health thing and have to go into a home or whatever. And so then I'm thinking about it, and then I'm also thinking about what's happening in single family homes. And it was interesting is because before the interest rates went up, everyone was talking about how we're in a housing crisis, right? Because there's a lot of people and not that many houses.
Yeah.
Interest rates go up and suddenly people like stop talking about it. They start talking about interest rates. Well, interest rates don't like take a gun and kill people. Like there's still like the same underlying dynamics of a housing shortage are still in play. Yeah. And NAR did a study where that 5 million houses needed to be built over the last decade that weren't. Mm. And then the other thing that people don't talk about, because I researched this a lot, is that Harvard did a study that through 2038, another 21 million houses are needed to be built.
Oh, wow.
And what's happening is Gen Z and millennials are in our, they were the biggest two demographics. I'm a really old millennial, but for some people that look at me and say, oh, well, how's he a millennial? I'm an old part one. But anyway, we're in our peak home buying years. We're the biggest demographics, and a lot of houses are needed to be built. And so then I'm talking to my friend Gary, who's been in new construction here in St. Louis for 40 years. And I say, hey, how are the new builds going? Oh, well, I have 500 employees on my team, and we're busy enough to have 1,000 people on our team, and I can't find anyone to hire.
Oh, wow.
So this market opportunity, you know, I think it's kind of, it doesn't take a genius to see that, whoa, this is a great buy and hold opportunity. We're in a housing crisis, a housing shortage. If we just buy and hold on to stuff, like we're going to be pretty good over the next 15 years. So I looked at my dad's situation. I looked at the market opportunity. And as an entrepreneur, it's like, well, like you call me a pragmatic altruist, right? You say like, and I like to solve problems. Like, well, my dad is not, I love him to death. He is not equipped to be a landlord. He's just not. Like, he is way too nice.
It's funny. That's like my dad.
he does not have the skills to do it.
Yeah.
And so I thought about it. I was like, well, I have the team to do it. And we're limited right now by the amount of capital that we have. And we can do enough deals for me. Like, and I'm okay. But man, I would feel amazing to help people like my dad out that and invest into an opportunity that creates truly passive income. That's a foundation for someone's retirement, because our strategy achieves that higher return than that lower risk profile. Right. And so then we opened up a real estate fund to allow us to scale up and not be limited by the amount of capital that we can afford on our own, take advantage of the market and help people at the same time that that want truly passive income. So so that's how we evolved and where we're at today.
Nice. I like that.
That's the world's longest answer for the question. You asked me the question.
Hey, man, we got there. That's all that matters. The fund model is fantastic. Syndications are great, but you sometimes they're difficult because you need to have the money when you find the deal. But with the fund model, the money's there. And so you can just go out there, do deals. So it sounds like you guys are going down the right path.
Yeah. And for single family homes too, like you're not going to do a syndication for every single house. Right. Like, I mean, you know, we
$10,000
lease purchase deals
in legal fees.
Yeah. We've done 340 of these lease purchase deals over the last 2 years alone. Like, we're not going to create 340 syndications. Like, you know, but it does make sense for an apartment complex that, you know, maybe the same volume, right?
Yeah.
As those 340 deals, but nice, yeah. Man. Yeah.
Well, I didn't mention before we got on here, but this is a short podcast. We try to keep it around the 20-minute mark, and we have already passed that. So I am going to push us on to the quick question round. Are you ready?
All right.
It starts with books or any form of education. I need two recommendations, one for general life wisdom and then one for real estate.
General life wisdom. You know, I'm going to go with a book that a lot of people haven't heard of. Relentless Solution Focus. Dr. Selk, maybe. I'm drawing a blank on him, but it's a very good way to look at problems and to kind of get out of your head. He has some really good tools on how to problem solve and stay in a good place, stay in like the pocket, so to speak, rather than get into that anxious state where you're just kind of stuck. So that on a personal level. On the real estate level, I don't know if I have a actual book. Like,
it could be anything.
Candid with
mastermind,
you.
Anything. Any
form. Yeah, I mean, for real estate, what's worked for me is doing like courses, but like I don't know if you even need courses as much anymore because of on like YouTube, you can find a lot of information out there now. But masterminds are good. I'm a part of one called Leadership Boardroom that I like. Sean McCloskey is the name of the guy who runs that. Getting into some sort of like mastermind or group or like mentorship, I think is more valuable. Finding someone that you can really trust to help you do deals and help prevent you from making mistakes that's been one of our keys to success. Is if we didn't know, we didn't know what we didn't know, so we would very much, you know, we spent hundreds of thousands of hours on coaching and mentorship or getting other more experienced people around us that we became friends with that gave us some pointers when we had questions.
Yeah. I feel like masterminds, it's better than any book you're going to read. In fact, I always say, just if you're going to get into real estate and you want education, don't stay too long in books. Read one, two books and then move on to something else, because books, you can really get stuck in them. This leadership boardroom, is that specific to St. Louis, or is it something that people can look at from all over the U.S.?
It's all over the U.S. Yep.
Cool. All right. Next question is for your younger self. So let's go back to the gym, who was graduating way back in 2006. Go back to him, look him in the eye, give him one piece of advice moving forward.
One piece of advice. Say never give up.
Yeah, that's good. Especially in real estate, because it's so easy to get kicked in the face a few times and be like, oh, I just can't do it anymore. But the key is to just keep taking those steps forward.
That's right. Yep.
All right. Next question is about your business. Every company starts with one person and then slowly builds out to a team. And the first three people you hire form the foundation of that team. What were they for you, and would you do it in a different order if you did it again today?
So we hired we brought on a agent as a salesperson. Then we brought on an administrative assistant. And then we brought on another agents. What we did, if I had to do it all over again, I would have brought on the administrative assistant first.
Yeah.
And then brought on the salespeople. But the one of the biggest mistakes I did was I also tried to bring in a VA to handle like marketing leads, inbound marketing leads. And that, and then all of a sudden, like my pay-per-click leads like weren't working anymore. And for some reason I couldn't figure it out. Well, it's the guy answering the phone. Like, I mean, St. Louis, Missouri people are amazing. They're so overall, we're very nice. And
but they don't want to
talk
Indian
to somebody from like India, like, you know, like that's just like a break in trust. And so then I dropped a whole marketing campaign thinking that it just wasn't working anymore when I created a problem, because I was trying to delegate like inbound lead calls, guys, is one of the very last things you should delegate out, because they're not going to answer the phone. They're not paying for the lead. They're not going to answer it the same way you do. They're not going to call them back as quickly as you will. That's one of the very last things to delegate.
Yeah. Yeah. That's a good point. Outbound, VAs calling out, they can definitely be, you know, out of the US with an accent, but, if somebody's calling inbound, then you definitely want them. And it's nothing against non-English accents. It's just that you're right. People do tend to hang up on those a little bit quicker. All right. Next question is about the US. It is a big place. There's a lot of opportunity out there. Give me the single metro outside of St. Louis that you're most excited about investing in today.
The single one outside of St. Louis. So my answer would be Kansas City.
Okay.
And it's not why you think. The reason why we like Kansas City is it's very similar to St. Louis.
Okay.
And we know St. Louis incredibly well. So it's not necessarily like, hey, this has the biggest growth opportunity. It really has more to do with our investing expertise and knowledge and wanting to go into a market similar to ours.
Yeah. And this is my ignorance about the U.S. map. Isn't Kansas City kind of close to St. Louis? No, it is not. Never mind. It's on the very opposite side of Missouri.
Yeah. I mean, it's only a 6-hour drive, though. It's relatively close.
Oh, okay. So. Okay. All right. Okay. Next question. This is about finding deals. It all starts with reaching out, getting in contact with the seller and writing up that purchase agreement. So what is your favorite way to generate leads and find good deals?
Our favorite ways is networking and just building relationships with agents and other wholesalers and investors. And the reason is, the cost per deal is, you know, you're not out anything up front. So when you make that buy, yeah, okay, the wholesaler will make a fee. I get that, but, we really have done, you know, in any given year, it's fluctuated from 20% to 50% marketing versus networking, but networking has always been one of our staples, and you just, it's just a very profitable way to go about it. So networking's really been our best one.
Yeah. Yep. It's all relationships, especially in real estate.
That's right.
All right. Second to last question. This is about lessons learned. Not every deal that we do goes the way we expect it. Sometimes a wrench is thrown into the mix, and things go a little sideways. But in those deals is the best lessons that we can take on to the next deal. So what was a deal that went a little sideways for you, and what was the lesson you pulled from it?
This will show you how inexperienced I was when I first started. We used to value properties solely by like price per square foot. We say, oh, well, this one sold for $100 per square foot, so this property we're evaluating should sell for the same. And we do a little bit of an adjustment if there was more square feet than another, but like we were very focused on that. And so I decided to buy a red barn. And I thought that it would get the same price as just a normal ranch. And
like an actual barn.
Yeah, it was like, that's a funny. Well, I mean, you know, it was a house, but like the front of it looked like a red barn.
Right.
And then finally, like we sell it, we made like a couple grand on it. And I was like, man, this price per square foot, we just got so low. I can't believe we made such a mistake. And then it dawned on me. I was like, well, just the common sense of it, like a woman makes the buying decision on a house. And there's a lot of women that don't want to live in a red barn. So it's like, okay. So it's funny how like there's just a common sense element to it, you know, that me being a guy, I was thick-headed, I guess, when I started.
Yeah. And it's really easy, especially in real estate, because it's so like analytical. And it's so easy to get wrapped up in the numbers and being like, yeah, this is, you know, $30 a square foot. This is $50 a square foot. So it has to be the same over here. And you just get really honed in on the numbers and you don't think about the things.
Yeah. And you overlook like things. This one backs to a highway. This one backed to a lake. Like,
right. Yep.
Like, duh, you know? So like, if you forget that, just so like, I think everyone's due diligence should like have a double check on like just the common sense elements on like, well, how do the locations compare, you know? Yeah. Like, is there things that are pluses on the checklist or are there things that are negative that detract? Yeah,
absolutely. All right. That leads us to the last question. This is for the listeners. You've given us a lot to think about. I'm sure people want to reach out, get in contact with you. How can they find you? And then what can they expect when they reach out?
Absolutely. Yeah. So if you could just go to my name, jimmanning.com. MANNING, just like Peyton Manning. So jimmanning.com. Unfortunately, I don't have the athletic ability that Peyton and his family has, but anyway, so just go there and, we have information. If you'd like to look into our real estate fund and being an investor, like there's information on there. If you'd like some information on some courses that we have, it's about $2,500 worth of courses that, just as a thank you for your audience, you can sign up and get them all for free, through the link. And I have a course on investing into real estate funds and like what due diligence you should go through. I have a course on generating passive income. We in 2022 we generated $5 million in passive income through three strategies I have in this course. I did a market analysis. I spent a ton of time looking into the single family space and what's going on in it, what's happening. Yeah, so I have a whole white paper on that in there. So just a ton of great quality information in there. And then, yeah, I mean, we're happy to sit down with anybody and have a call too. So just jimmanning.com and take a look and sign up for whatever resource you want.
All right. Yeah. Perfect. I will put that link in the show notes. So if you guys want to reach out, just click the little more in the description. It'll pull down that full description and in there you can find Jim's link. All right, Jim, that wraps it up. Thank you very much for hopping on the show.
Thank you, Gabe. And hey guys, sorry that we ran so over. I guess I was a little talkative today.
It's a morning conversation. We're doing as we please.
That's right.
All right. Well, for everybody who is still with us today, thank you guys for showing up. You are the reason we do this. So if you guys have any questions, reach out to me, Gabe at therealestateinvestingclub.com. If you want to support the show, just give us a like, subscribe, share, all that jazz. Other than that, I hope you guys have a great week. Keep rocking real estate, and I look forward to seeing you on the next episode. All right. Before I officially sign off, I have a quick announcement to make. If you're interested in becoming a passive investor in one of my deals, my own company, Kaizen Properties, is looking for capital partners for our upcoming projects. We invest in what are known as recession-resistant assets, mainly self-storage facilities, mobile home and RV parks, and industrial properties. If you're interested in investing and would like to learn a little bit more about my company, our investing criteria, and some of the previous projects we've done, go to the Real Estate Investing Club podcast at therealestateinvestingclub.com and scroll all the way down to the bottom of the page. Click on the Invest With Us button. That'll pop up the investor form. Fill that out and we will reach back out to you as soon as we can. Or if you prefer a little bit more of a personal touch, you can reach out to me at gabe@therealestateinvestingclub.com. So really, that is it. Again, it was a pleasure hanging out with you guys during this episode, and I look forward to seeing you on the next episode.